You're listening to Afternoon Jazz at 90.5 FM, WSNC Winston-Salem, your genuine jazz station from the campus of Winston-Salem State University. I'm Jim Steele. Great being with you this afternoon for some jazz music. It's 4:35. We've got clear skies out there, about 89 degrees on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. Love the hot weather. And I won't be looking forward to anything colder than this. But it's going to happen, I understand. We just heard music from Reuben Wilson, a recording called Blue Break Beats. And the cut we heard was called Bus Ride. Before that, it was Lady K and the Kings of Swing with the Bare Necessities. And Graham Dechter brought us Come Rain or Come Shine from a recording called Taking It There. Loads of folks in the studio this afternoon. When one of our guests, Sarah McCoy, was here a few weeks ago, she was in town for Bookmarks. And Bookmarks, of course, is the largest book festival in North and South Carolina. Just a whole lot of fun. And we love being a part of that event every year. And so Sarah and I had a nice chat. And when she was leaving, we were both thinking the same thing. Hey, why don't you come back and you can talk about books? And she said, well, I know people who write books and I'll bring them on. And I said, well, how cool is that? And it was like we were both reading each other's minds. And so Sarah is here. Her guest and our new friend is Emily Griffin. Both of them are New York Times bestselling authors. Emily Griffith is an alumna of Wake Forest University. Go Deeks.
Go Deeks.
Welcome. And Sarah McCoy, of course, is here now. She lives here. And her husband is head of the sports docs at Wake Forest Baptist. Anyhow, Emily Griffith, native of Chicago, Wake Forest University alumna in town. And she and her three children, one of which of whom is here.
Yay.
Harriet is here. They live in Atlanta. So apparently, both women said, that's enough of Chicago. It's too cold. Let's come down, and we're going to live here where it's nice and warm. And I get that completely. But anyhow, both are here, and we're going to talk about, of course, about books. Sarah McCoy, of course, is a marvelous writer of historical fiction. And she was at Bookmarks, and she was talking about a very exciting book about which has to deal with slavery and abolitionists and all that sort of thing. And Sarah, tell us about your event. Remind us of the book and what was your discussion like? Because it was very timely to have that discussion.
Yeah. Well, first off, hi. Welcome. I'm so excited to be back here, and I'm so excited to have Emily here. I mean, this is such a treat to have a friend in the studio, and it feels like we didn't really know each other, and then we met just now, and it was...
We've known each other for
years. Years, you all. You don't even understand. I wish everyone out there listening was here in the studio. It's kind of a girl party we're having with Harriet, too.
And Jim.
I'm just listening.
Yes.
I'm just facilitating.
Okay. Yes, but the Bookmarks
Festival,
wonderful. Yeah, I want you to come.
You know, I came a few years ago, but it's been a little while, but it's a really good one. I mean, you know, as a writer, we go to a lot of them.
Right.
It is definitely one of the best in the country. So y'all are so lucky to have this here in Winston-Salem.
Come back, and then you'll know someone in the city. We'll go out. I can take you around. Bring Harriet.
Harriet can come back. Harriet's out of school for 2 days, everyone.
Oh, so she's out of school, but
she's missing school with the permission of the principal.
She also, little Miss Harriet, has something with her foot. She has a boot on right now, and my ortho-trained spidey senses living with my husband just honed me in on that, and I thought, oh my gosh, what's going on? So if you're out there listening, Dr. Waterman, which I think you are, her foot, she's got a boot on.
Sesamoiditis.
Something is sesamoiditis, yes. Whatever that is, I would love to introduce Miss Harriet to him one day soon. So you all have to come back for the festival. And it was grand this year. They did such a good job. The ladies who run it just really put their heart and soul into it. And
absolutely.
I was on a panel with Robert Hicks and Darren Wang. I mean, just two gentlemen who are lights of the South, let me tell you. And if you all are listening out there, guys, I love you and I miss you and come back. But they had me rolling, laughing, just having a good time, even while we were talking about these very deep, dark things. So it was a wonderful conversation. It was a good discussion. The audience was great. And Yeah, we talked about how the Civil War and the things that are went on back then are still pertinent today to our society and haven't really haven't moved past some things, which is scary and sad. So,
but we're continuing the conversation.
Yes.
And we're bringing more people in.
Conversation is so important.
Exactly.
Right. Talk about these things.
Exactly. And your book, of course, and we talked about this before, your book, The Mapmaker's Children, gives us a completely different point of view of the abolitionist and the Underground Railroad and all that was involved in that. And you did it from the perspective of the daughter. But we're not going to go into your story.
I would like to make one little tie-in here. Your Map Maker's Children is about the Underground Railroad, and my daughter's named Harriet.
Harriet.
Hello.
Tubman.
Harriet Tubman.
Shout out.
After Harriet Tubman.
Your mama loves you. Yes. That was a good name.
So, yeah, isn't it a strong name?
I love
Between
I
Harriet
really
the
do.
Spy and Harriet Tubman?
Yeah.
I mean, those are some real
That means that you're going to, you're already on your way to being having some mark on history. She's raising her hands like, I don't know what you people are talking about. A mark on history. A woman of power. Yes.
You have the best titles, too.
You know what? That wasn't
It snowed in Puerto Rico.
I really want to talk about that book.
Yes.
We'll get into that conversation.
Yes. Really good, strong title.
Well, you know what? You, though, are writing, too, a lot of stories set in the South and contemporary South. And so I feel like there is I mean, I'm writing about the past and these things that happened in the South. You're writing about the present and things. And even if, like, First Comes Love is about sisters. And yet
it is. Do you have a sister?
I don't. And I was going to ask. I was going to bring this up. I am the eldest of two brothers.
Okay.
And I grew up, though, with a mom who had two sisters. And so I watched that sister.
Very different dynamic, isn't it?
Oh, God. And I was so jealous. It was like a secret language that my mom and my aunts shared. And I just was so jealous of it because I didn't have that.
Were you, or was there any part of you, you know, I'm one of two girls, two sisters.
I was going to ask you,
two sisters. But in my own family, I'm the reverse of your mother. I have two boys, twin sons, and Harriet. And you know, I think there's part of her that almost is glad that she doesn't have to vie for the, well, here she is on a solo trip with me, you know. So
true.
Maybe that creates a stronger bond with just others in your life, whether it's your best friend or your mother or so forth. But I feel fairly certain that you don't have a lot of relationship voids in your heart, Sarah, just from knowing you this long, 20 minutes.
I just stop and think, I'm like, do I have...
No.
You know what? I would say, though, that I am very loyal because I didn't have that sisterhood. I am very loyal to the few, you know...
So you probably have more intense female friendships.
Exactly.
Yes.
My female friends, I'm intensely loyal to. And I seek out that kind of fidelity, that kind of trust.
Intimacy and connection.
Right.
Absolutely.
And
right.
I don't have a lot of surface girlfriends, which can be difficult, though. But I feel like I never learned how to be surfacey because my one girlfriend in my home was my mother.
Right.
And we
right.
were very close. And it was very deep, that
sure,
relationship.
Sure.
But I never learned how to – I was never that girl who had a gaggle.
Do you think that would have been different had you had a sister? Or do you think that's the way you're wired?
See, that's what I was going to ask you. Having sisters, do
you,
how are you wired? Can you have, like, a bunch of girlfriends and you go out and you – is that feel
I think
natural?
That's really function, bringing up another book. What Susan – who wrote Quiet? I'm blanking
oh,
on
yes,
that.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh, about name. Introvert, extrovert.
Yes.
Yes.
Which we could have a whole little side conversation about that. But just how you're wired in terms of
I completely
that.
Believe
but
in that.
The troubled female friendship, whether it's your sister or your best friend, the undercurrent that can happen with women, I think as a result of how much we bond and how deep those relationships go, I think is something that I like to explore, whether, you know, in my first book, Something Borrowed, it was an only child, and then her best friend only had a brother. But they had that, you know, intense relationship with a sort of troubled undercurrent. And these sisters definitely have that as well.
Right. And that's
and Josie and Meredith in First Comes Love.
Exactly. That sisterhood, I was fascinated by and curious because, I don't have sisters in my own life, and so I wondered about that. And it also translated, I thought about the past, and I wrote about Sarah Brown and her sister, and that is a relationship that I almost got to live that sisterhood through them because I don't, again, have it in my own world, but you write so well about these contemporary relationships too, and how these dynamics affect who we are, and even how the culture affects then those relationships. So it was my tie together of the books is that Southern culture, it's not just a historical thing. You bring it in right now to your contemporary characters and to the women who are living in these different places.
And even this, just the sibling relationship period, I think, is so fascinating. And obviously, you know, in First Comes Love, there's the two sisters have lost their older brother in a car accident, which happens in the prologue, so I'm not giving anything away there. But it's fascinating to me how different we can be in the same family. You sort of assume that there's going to be this, you have this strong shared context, and you have the same nature and the same nurture, and you think that you're going to see eye to eye. And there's, I think we're capable of some of the, you know, the biggest misunderstandings within our own families, and perhaps it's because we assume that surely they understand all of the subtext. And we don't. And in this, in First Comes Love, these two women are so fundamentally at odds, and they're not even really aware of why that is. So I think it's...
In real life, I know, but in real life, are you and your sisters dramatically different, or would you say you're...
So I have just one, my older sister, Sarah, and...
I didn't know that! Yes, oh, my gosh!
With an H.
so perfect. No wonder we feel like we know each
that
other already.
That must be it. But she, you know, she and I are very, very close, and yet we are so different, so very different, just... And so I think sometimes we do confront that moment where, I think we just make assumptions about what the other is feeling based on what we would feel, and we're capable of some, pretty big misunderstandings. Fortunately, we communicate and we're so close that they're always short-lived, but,
I have my two younger brothers, and I'm very close with my brothers, and we are so different. My next younger brother, not the youngest, but my next younger, his name's Jason, and he and I we grew up in the same household. We get in arguments sometimes because he'll say, I grew up in the same house you did, so don't think you're telling me anything new. And yet we are so vastly different in how we see the world.
And some of that might be birth order.
Middle child.
But it's just relationships are complex.
Between the introvert and extrovert, I totally adhere to that. And then the middle child, first child...
Very much so.
I completely...
And what do they say? They say that you're not supposed to marry your birth order.
Well, I married the baby of the family. It's my husband. Okay. So I can I see that.
You see that?
Yeah.
I married the baby of the family, and so am I, that we're in trouble. But I behave more like the firstborn in my family because my sister's only 14 months older than I. So maybe that helps. So you didn't know you were going to get this birth order conversation over here, did
we kind of went off on our own. Jim is like, what?
That's okay.
Please, Jim.
He's looking
in.
He's looking at our
little... I was making corrections because I've been... Anyway, I'm making corrections and make sure I get name spellings and all that right.
Yeah, you're great.
But anyhow, but we're talking about... What I find fascinating is the type of book that you write, Emily, and the type of book Sarah writes. Because Sarah writes historical fiction.
Right, sure.
And you write... fiction, love stories, contemporary. Yeah. How would you
contemporary
just, what do you
women.
Just, okay, contemporary, yeah. okay, this, yeah. that's like a whole new category.
Yeah. Well,
yeah,
I mean,
but I think at the same time, I think that what drives, you know, both of our stories is just the complexity of relationships, you know, and I think that that's...
Characters.
That's characters.
Right.
And, you know, strong, in the case of the two books that we're talking about now, strong women.
Right.
Well,
we have strong men in them too, though. So don't. Feel
yeah, we no, definitely yes. we sprinkle.
But you know
sprinkle.
What I find interesting in your conversation about how you describe your relationships with other women and your friendships, and it kind of reminds me of the kind of friendships that I have, and that is I pretty much call my friendships romantic relationships because I don't have a lot of friends, but when I do, it's like I fall in love with them. They don't
That's
do anything
nice.
Wrong.
Yeah.
And I overlook everything, and they're just, you know, so it's very intimate
in that
way. So I guess that is the closest I can get to understanding relationships between two women because I consider them very romantic
relationships. We were saying that Harriet, tell them what you were saying about Abby. Yes.
Come, Harriet. We want Harriet.
Okay, so Harriet has a very, very best friend, and tell us what you said about her, about your need to, your philosophy on friendship.
I don't need a whole posse of friends.
There you go. I
need one.
Yeah, just a few good
men. I don't put that on, embroider it on a pillow. I don't need a posse of friends. I just need one. That is gospel, yeah. Let me tell you. I feel this, well, because I feel this, I feel passionately the same way. Like, I just need my good group of friends that I can really, really trust and know I can be who I am and not be judged and not be criticized and not be,
And Harry gets it now, and it takes some of us, you know, 20, 30, 40 years to get to that point.
Yeah, and some of my friends... Maybe I'm, you know, meeting now and it'll take that long and I'll be, you know, that's the beauty of friendships is that they're continually growing and blossoming and new ones are coming up. So
now I'm curious, Sarah, do you feel critical of your characters as you're writing? Like, do you, are you usually all in on their side the way you are with your own friendships, or do you feel like you can be critical of them?
A good question. I think I am critical. Mm-hmm. Of them, and yet at the same time, I always find that nugget, even if I'm ashamed to say it, of why I sympathize.
Why I
wrote from the perspective of a Nazi officer in The Baker's Daughter, and at the book festival, someone asked me, "How can you write from such unlikable, despicable characters? How do you psychologically get into that to do it?" And I said, well, you have to find
something
rationale that they, and you have to remember, they are human.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they had to somehow, they're not monsters, they're not demons, they're not something that we can't explain. They are human. And so you have to get inside and find some sympathetic something that made them do that.
Maybe relatability.
Right.
You know,
when I say sympathy, I mean where you can see where they had twisted things to see something.
Well, you have a lot of material to draw on with what's happening just in our country and right now. I mean, the lines are...
There is, but because I write historical fiction... I feel like it's something like you. I would love, I could totally imagine you, you know, just being able to write about what's going on right now. And for me, I almost need that time buffer.
Right.
Not just in my work, but personally,
But you're drawing, what I sort of mean is you must be drawing on those emotions that are modern day as you're writing about, you know, your character set in the past, because it's so...
And you have to be careful, too, because you have to remember that they are from the past. You have to have, like, a soft compassion for the fact that in the past, religion was everything. That was law. You know, John Brown, that his daughter, Sarah Brown, was the main character of Mapmaker's Children, and religion was everything. You, as a woman, were expected to marry in the church and have children because you were the seed of Abraham, and the seed of Abraham was supposed to procreate, and that was the way the world went. And so that, you know, it shakes both of us up, and I'm a very... And this is out there in public, so I'm not saying anything new, but I'm a feminist. You know, I'm all about strong females.
I'm there with you.
Yeah. And so to read that and have to put my head back into that subservient female role.
Sure.
That was hard to kind of quiet my modern thinking. And at the same time, I felt like I learned so much because I realized as much as we think we're so modern, we still, so many things Sarah Brown faced...
There's still judgment around.
Yes.
You know, one of the books, my third book is called Baby Proof, but it shouldn't have had the word baby in the title because it's not about babies. It's about a woman who doesn't want to have a child.
Great title.
Yeah, but is it though? I don't think it is, because I think people see baby and they assume like if they're out of that mode or they're not. I think it's a pretty weak title.
But you can't stop talking about it because it gives you a place to go, whether you find it repulsive or whether you find it right on point.
Maybe. But the idea that sort of is a taboo against women, the final taboo, I think, in a lot of ways. You can be a stay-at-home mother or you can be a working mother, but if you don't want children, and it's also fine if you can't have them, because then you can be, you know, sympathetic figure, you know, she couldn't have them. But if you choose not to, I think that there's still assumptions that society makes about...
Amen. And I can speak directly to that because I don't have children.
So, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, I don't have children, and there is a stigma, and that's part of what led me to write this book.
It's so frustrating, isn't it?
That's funny because women friends that I have who have husbands, but they don't have children for whatever reason, people look at them differently. Like,
that's what I didn't even know that when I brought up this topic.
You're just kind of
buddies. I love that
you
did.
Yeah.
And it's not really that.
No, it's also why.
Why?
Why? Why?
Or
so
when?
They want to know. They
Are
want
you
to
waiting?
Know,
what do you...
Or at some point, if it becomes evident that it's that the answer's no, then it's why. They want to know. Like, and I think that that's, you know, that's something that... So the first sentence of that book that I wrote, which I'm, you know, I haven't talked about in 10 years, really. It came out in 2006, but is I never wanted to be a mother. Mm. And my editor said, well, how do we have to shouldn't we tone that down? It's rather unsympathetic. I'm like, how is that unsympathetic? It's a choice. She didn't say I had a child and I didn't want to take care of her. That's something that you can come at with some judgment. I mean,
just find that fascinating because one of my first women bosses, her secretary pulled me aside and said, don't ever bring up the subject. She doesn't have children. She doesn't want children. I was thinking to myself, okay, so what?
Yeah.
I wouldn't bring it up anyway. But there was that stigma there, yeah. And it was a very sensitive subject.
Well, the fact that you don't bring it up. So, like, you know, we got a dog a year and a half ago, Golden Retriever. Oh. We made the decision to get a dog. For all the years before that, I there was no judgment. Like, why don't you have it? Like,
no.
You know what I mean? It's like, it's just a choice.
Well,
like,
certain circles. I mean, I would have given you the snake eye if you told me you didn't have a dog. I really kind of worry.
Yeah, I'm one of those people.
Jim.
This is a wrap, Jim. Well, but it's just a life. It's just a life choice.
Yeah,
and I think it's fascinating. But
an interesting story I just had happen. I had a woman come over who was helping me do some things around my house, and I just got talking with her, and she said, so do you have children? And I said, no, we don't. And I just left it at that, and we kept going. And then she said, well, you know, I have a green juice drink that'll fix whatever's wrong with you.
Oh, you're kidding.
No. Oh, Emily.
2017. Right? You got the green juice?
I have a green juice drink that'll fix whatever's wrong with you. I was just like, what? What?
What did you say?
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's so gracious of you. But I'm really fine. Real fine, actually.
You were raised well. I have another girlfriend who didn't have children. She has kids now. But she said, when somebody asks her that question, she says, I'm barren.
No. Just straight face. That's going to be my new line. Just straight face.
Well, that word.
It just sort of ends
the
conversation and, you know. Yeah.
But then again, like you said, Emily, then there's that also that sympathetic, oh, she's messed up. And I never want that, you know, on me. Like, oh, that's why. Like, this is a choice. This is how life is. I'm very happy. So could things change in the future? Possibly. Could they not? Very possibly. So you take what...
And life is always about, you know, choices that you can't... This whole idea of having it all is so absurd. You cannot have it all. Everything is a compromise. You give up something to get something out. You know, But grown-ups that offered her green juice don't seem to know it. But
I'm like, preach. Church of Emily. Preach.
And Sarah. Emily and Sarah. I just spoke to with a class over at Wake Forest, a Jane Austen class, and we're talking about Jane Austen.
Oh,
you know, everyone knows her story, but, you know, she passed away at 41, never was married, had, I think, five suitors or at least several... Chose not to go down that road, obviously didn't have children. And, you know, if you think back, if she had, we wouldn't have her six books, probably, given the time.
Yeah.
As you're the master of that historical context. But
books, in general, are like children. I mean, you raise them. We sit with them for a long time.
You birth them painfully.
Birth them. And it takes months and months.
And I'm not just saying that because I'm 66,146 words into my next book.
Oh,
and I know the word. No,
that's
not. I should be at like 85. But
no,
if you know
the
word count,
end.
that I think, yeah, the two-thirds mark, right?
Oh, my gosh.
Something like that.
Is it? It's another... Okay, I have to dig into this. Is this another contemporary...
It is. It is this one, All We Ever Wanted, is more about...
Did you hear that, guys? All We Ever Wanted title.
We're out of time. You're listening to 90.5 FM, WSNC Winston-Salem, your genuine jazz station from the campus of Winston-Salem State University. Thank you, ladies, for coming by. We'll continue this conversation. Emily Griffin, Sarah McCoy, New York Times best-selling authors, and now friends of WSNC
Radio.
Oh, yes.
You too,
Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh,
my God.
State University and R&R Productions bring you the Ram Super Lounge Experience for one night only, Friday, October 27th. Join WSSU at the Benn Convention Center, 301 West 5th Street, Winston-Salem, for an unforgettable night of music and dancing. One ticket gives you access to the main stage at the best-selling Grammy-nominated SWV. And the SOS Band.
90.5 FM WSNC Winston-Salem, a broadcast service of Winston-Salem State University.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. In Puerto Rico, hospitals are slowly coming back online. White House advisor Tom Bossert says 44 of the island's 69 hospitals are now operational.
Energy here, electric power, is supplying the hospitals that are providing medical care to the wounded and those that brought medical conditions and had chelation needs and other needs. So there's a kind of a dual priority going on in terms of power restoration, emergency power, and then blocking, clearing, pushing out of the way all the roads to open them up so we can get commodities delivered.
He says the mountainous interior of the island is now the problem area for delivering aid supplies. The island's power grid was destroyed in Hurricane Maria. Food, water, fuel, and cash remain in short supply. Meanwhile, San Juan's airport is packed with people trying to leave the island. NPR's Marisa Penaloza is there. She says it's very hot and crowded, over 100 degrees, with no air conditioning.
The situation here is dire. Everybody has either handheld fan or they're making fans with cardboard.
And she says there are a lot of elderly people in wheelchairs and many children waiting to board planes.
Many are Puerto Ricans who live on the island and they're trying to escape. There are other people who were caught here while they were visiting or working. And now that commercial flights are open, they're heading back.
And some airlines are not accepting e-tickets, adding to the long lines. Vice President Mike Pence traveled to Michigan today to tout the Trump administration's proposed tax plan. As Quinn Kleinfelter of member station WDET reports, Pence says the plan will be a, quote, miracle for the middle class.
Trump won Michigan by vowing to bring manufacturing jobs back to the state. The vice president says the administration's tax proposal will do just that by cutting business taxes he says hinder job creation. Pence told a crowd of workers at a plant near Detroit that the plan also saves them money by simplifying the tax code and doubling the standard deduction.
Despite what you might hear from the liberal left and some voices in the national media, tax cuts mean more jobs. Tax cuts mean higher wages. Tax cuts mean more money in your pocket on payday.
He did not say how the cuts would be paid for. Democrats say the plan benefits the wealthy and big corporations at the expense of the middle class. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
The number of Americans applying for first-time unemployment claims rose last week. The Labor Department says initial jobless claims were up by 12,000 to 272,000. The less volatile four-week moving average rose by 9,000 to 277,750. Wall Street was higher by the closing bell. The Dow up 40 points at 22,381. The Nasdaq up a fraction at 6453. The S&P 500 up 3 at 2510. You're listening to NPR News. Julia Louis-Dreyfus has been diagnosed with breast cancer. The Veep and Seinfeld actor treated that one in eight American women get breast cancer, saying, "Today, I am one." Louis-Dreyfus said she had a wonderful health insurance, but noted many women don't and called for universal health care. This month, she won her sixth Emmy for Veep. The FBI held a formal ceremony today to welcome its new director, Christopher Wray. NPR's Ryan Lucas has more.
Wray was officially sworn in as FBI director in early August in a private ceremony at the Justice Department. Thursday's festivities at FBI headquarters in Washington provided the Bureau a public opportunity to formally welcome its new director. Members of Congress, the Attorney General, as well as Wray's own family were in the crowd. Taking the podium, Wray vowed to uphold the Bureau's fundamental mission.
We're going to follow the facts independently, no matter where they lead and no matter who likes it.
He also promised the FBI would evolve to stay one step ahead of the threats facing the country, such as cyber attacks, espionage, and terrorism. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Shares of the streaming company Roku are higher today after its initial public offering raised $219 million. The company's stock rose 67% by the close. Roku is known for its digital boxes and sticks that let users watch Netflix, Hulu, and other streaming videos on their TVs. But the company is unprofitable and has $244 million in losses since it was founded in 2002. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Farmers Insurance, committed to making the world a smarter place through shared knowledge and experience. Tales of home, car, and other insurance coverage can be found at farmers.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's 5:06. You're listening to Afternoon Jazz at 90.5 FM, WSNC Winston-Salem, your genuine jazz station from the campus of Winston-Salem State University. I'm Jim Steele. Great being with you this afternoon. We got jazz music coming up, but we're going to continue our conversation, you know, the one we were listening in on, between New York Times best-selling authors Emily Griffin and Sarah McCoy. They're in the studio talking about books, of course. And also, Emily's going to be speaking at Wake Forest University this evening, and she and Sarah are going to talk about that, and we hope you'll take part in that event. Of course, the public is invited.
Yes, come out.
Hey,
7:30.
We're back. Yes, tonight Emily is going to be speaking in the library series for Wake Forest, and it's free, as Jim said, open to the public. So jump in your cars, make plans, whatever you got to do. Come on out and hear her. She's phenomenal and so warm and generous. You
and
really
alumna,
have been.
Alumna of Wake Forest.
Right, right, right. And, of course, go,
go Deeks.
Deeks. So
now, of course, Emily was there, like, you know, years and years and years after I was there, because when I was there, there were no women on the quad.
Oh, wow.
There was no air conditioning on the quad. You could drink at 18, but there was no liquor bottle to drink here. So it was pretty much the Baptist institution that
came there. Still is.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So it was a very different time. But then, again, the whole world was, I guess.
So, yeah, come on out tonight.
Has it changed a lot since you were here, when you're here driving through or anything?
I loved it then.
Yeah.
And I love coming back. It feels like coming home. It really does.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm very proud of Wake Forest. It feels like it's grown a lot, and it's become more diverse than what I remember when I matriculated in 1990. So I like that about it. I like the direction that we seem to be moving in, and but it's just always wonderful to come home.
Yeah, I've just moved here, so it is my new home, even though it's your old home.
That's
and it
right.
does feel like, I guess
there's a lot going on.
Yeah,
here.
It's like a small town heart, but it's becoming a big city, which is really beautiful to be a part of it now, coming
yeah,
into it. But
sure.
You got the Dixie Fair tomorrow.
Yes,
that's been going on a while. Hasn't
I think
it?
So.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's our county fair.
But you need to. I want Emily to come back often.
Yeah,
come visit.
Well, I will,
like I said earlier, I think off air, though, I will take you out. We will go around. We'll visit the bookstore.
And we'll invite everyone back to that, too.
Yeah.
Yes.
Shots with Sarah, we'll call it.
Oh.
Is that inappropriate?
There's
no.
Another story there. We'll get to it another time.
Okay.
Emily just signed me up for something. I don't know what.
but anyway, Emily, back to your talk tonight.
Yes.
Where is it going to be on the campus of Wake Forest?
Brendel Chambers? Hall.
Brendel Recital Hall?
Yes. It's free and it'll be a lot of fun. Nice dialogue, conversation.
Excellent. And Sarah, your next trip is, you said you were going someplace that sounded kind of cold. And why? Why
I am,
are you going
next
there?
Week I'm going to Canada.
Okay, it's not too bad.
Yeah, I'm going up to
You're
Prince.
You're really hung up on that weather thing, aren't you?
You know what? You know what? Let me tell you why. Harriet, I got cold once.
I like snow.
I like snow. It's kind of nice, but
nice in theory.
But in my house, I had a house, and I always was used to warmth, and I was upstairs, and it was really cold, and so there was a heat pump upstairs. The heat pump came on, and I smelled something that smelled like the house was burning down, which was the Reserve. So I turned it off. I sat in my bed. I was freezing. I was wrapped up, and I said, cold is bad. I hate cold. I do not like cold. So that was more than you needed.
That's the color that we crave in our fiction and in real life.
Right.
Yeah. How long ago was that?
It was a long time ago.
And now he's like Canada.
Well, that's the reason I'm going now, though. I'm not going in the winter months, but I'm going to do research on my next contracted book. It's called Marilla. Do you know Anne of Green Gables?
Oh, yeah.
So
I'm answering for her.
Yes. Oh my God, you are my like soul people. So I'm writing Marilla.
I'm writing her story.
It's due to my editor at Christmas at HarperCollins, William Morrow.
What's the title?
Marilla.
Oh, Marilla.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that so it's due then, and I'm going to go up to Prince Edward Island next week, and I'm going to spend a while in Canada.
That is
Halifax.
Awesome.
I'm going to go. I'm going to drive it. I'm going to take the ferry. I'm going to do all those things. I'm going to finish this book. That's why I'm there, to finish. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
So that's my big trip coming up, and the next book, too. So, yeah. And then tell us again for this group, what's the name of the title of your next book?
Oh, the one that I'm working on?
Yes.
The one, it's the first,
sure.
It's really about, race, social class, messy relationships that I always write about. But it's called All We Ever Wanted.
All We Ever Wanted.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that.
Me too.
I like messy relationships.
It's messy.
Like I said earlier, she has the perfect opportunity to write about contemporary characters struggling with contemporary issues like race and... the political stuff. I don't know if there is any.
There's always a pressure.
And how do you
forgive? How do you move on? What part of that is there a redemption?
Yeah.
Can you find redemption in these situations or not? And it's set in the context of a private school in Nashville, a very elite private school. And
my mother is the principal of a elite private school in D.C.
Maybe I could go do some research with her while
really
you're
curious.
I've been doing your Marilla research.
Wow.
So
this sounds good.
Yeah, and then what do you do when it's your own child? How do you deal with that? You want to see the good in your own child, but sometimes, you can't.
That sounds really good.
So,
Gosh.
I have to finish writing it, though. You can help me with the ending.
Yeah, finish.
Jim, you want to help, too?
Just
take a chapter. Take one for the team.
Send it to me. I'm a good editor. Okay. So send it to me. I would be delighted to read
it. I'm so excited
for
this. I might
so
add some other characters.
Yes, thank you for taking time to come and talk with us. And this has been so much fun. She'll be back, guys. Don't worry. I'll bring her back.
Oh, and Emily McCoy.
Emily McCoy. I'll be Emily McCoy.
Sarah McCoy, you will be back.
Yes, I'll be back.
We are tongue-in-cheek calling this Bookmarked with Sarah McCoy. And so you will drop in capriciously with or without guests to talk about books and writing and important issues like that. And Emily Giffen will look forward to hearing more about this book. I'm excited about this next book that you're writing because it sounds like it's going to be really, really juicy.
Yes.
The door's open. Okay, the door's open.
You.
This is public radio.
Yeah.
This is what we do. Plus, we're on a college campus. You got to talk about books on a college
campus.
That's right.
So
thank you both.
We will see Emily, and I hopefully will see all of you readers and listeners with me in the audience to cheer her on tonight. Remember, 7:30, Brendel Recital Hall on Wake Forest. Come. It's going to be so fun.
And the time again?
7:30.
You're listening to 90.5 FM, WSNC Winston-Salem, your genuine jazz station from the campus of Winston-Salem State University. Thank you very much to Sarah McCoy and Emily Giffen for coming by and talking with us about books. We're going to go back to jazz music right now. This is from Joe Sample. This is called Miles of Blue from a 1996 recording. You're listening to Afternoon Jazz.
Thank you. Next time on Piano Jazz, Marianne McPartland's guest from 2003 is Tony Caramia, world-class teacher and educator, skilled in both classical and jazz. That's Tony Caramia on the next Piano Jazz from NPR Music.
Tonight at 10 p.m. on 90.5 WSNC and WSNCradio.org. Thank you.